and welcome to Who Is She? A Bechdel Test First podcast. For each episode, we usually champion and discuss a pioneering woman in film who we think should be on your radar. But for this episode, we're going to champion a lot of women because this is our end of year poll pod special. I'm your host, Beth Webb, and I'm joined for this episode by my regular Bechdel Test First partners in crime. If you could please introduce yourselves.
Hello, I'm Caitlin Quinlan.
Hi, I'm Karina Antrobus.
Hi, I'm Steph Watts.
Now, Karina, there are millions, trillions of end-of-year polls out there in the world. Why did we decide to introduce another one?
I mean, part of the whole reason of setting up Bechdel Test First in the first place was to make sure that we were shining a light on the views and opinions of women in film. And as female film critics ourselves, I'm sure you can all agree that it's quite... You do tend to find yourself as the marginalised one in most of the press screenings. And a lot of times I was just more interested in the female view and female opinion on some of the films that were most important to me. I know I still look for female film critics when I'm looking for a really lovely analysis of something that has resonated with me in particular. So I just wanted to create the poll to really just rise up and increase the volume of female film critics, because we're still so the balance is completely off still.
And how have you found the past few years in comparison to this one? What have you tend to notice when we are, you know, sat racking up the results every December?
This one has been really interesting, I think. I mean, dare I say it, it's been an unprecedented year. And I think these results do reflect the difference in releases and what people have been resonating with in comparison to the other years. I mean, we don't have any blockbusters, for instance, and obviously blockbusters have really suffered this year, but with cinemas closing through to lockdown. We've had loads more independent films this year. And yeah, ultimately, again, it is a really, really good diverse list. I think this is the most diverse in terms of people of colour, and I think this one has most of the films actually passing the test as well. A couple kind of scrape, but ultimately they still have really positive representation for women in film. They're all really escapist, and I think this is what we've already needed this year as well. Just something to really lose yourself in and just forget about all the nonsense that's going on outside.
It's an interesting year as well. I'm thinking in terms of like headlines for this year, how we've come across. It's interesting you've mentioned this kind of swirling representation, especially after there were, at the beginning of the year, you know, a disheartening announcement that there were no female directors at the Oscars, being one of them. So to see that swirling representation is really encouraging. We also had Weinstein and the big announcement that he was being imprisoned, which was a huge move of validation to the Me Too movement as well. So I think we are really starting to see a positive shuffle. We'll call it a positive shuffle. We're not striding necessarily, but a positive shuffle into a sort of a bigger future.
Yeah, I would say, and it's funny because every time Weinstein comes up, it's almost like that is just such a far off thing that happened now, but it's still so important that we don't forget that that happened this year. I think it's a really important thing that we do remember, and actually a lot of the female blockbuster directed films that were due to come out this year, there are reports talking about how the Weinstein effect has caused a lot of distributors to look to female directors to direct their bigger blockbuster films because they wanted to be seen to being responsive to that awful chapter in film history. However, then they've been up against the issues of not being able to release their films into cinemas. The prime example was obviously Wonder Woman. You know, it's now going to HBO Max, whatever that is, on Christmas Day. But, you know, it's a shame. Yeah. But yeah, we've still got a long way to go, but there is little glimmers of hope.
Now, I want to talk some more about these big, beautiful stories. Female folk stories that are making their way onto big screens, mostly small screens this year. Steph, could you walk us through some of the big fist in the air, heart swelling moments that you've seen on big and small screens for female focused films this year?
Yeah, sure. Well, if we're not counting Dolly Parton singing in Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, then there's been a lot. I mean, I'm kind of thinking instantly of Parasite, the kind of Jessica only child, Illinois, Chicago, that Park So-dam is now very, very famous for and probably really sick of doing now. But that definitely seemed to define kind of the first half of the year. Also thinking of Harley Quinn eating an enormous egg muffin, really, really hungover in Kathy Ann's Birds of Prey, which is just like such a joyful film as well. I know, I think that was like really lucky to be able to see that in a cinema. Yeah, like, I mean, just as you were saying, Karina, about like Wonder Woman kind of going on streaming services, that is such like a kind of joyful, like women-led film that really, really worked, I think. And yeah, was like an absolute joy to see. What else? We had a lot of armpit sex in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which I know is our... a small amount, a small graphic, a short close-up, extreme close-up, interesting moment. I feel like that film gave us so many moments. Maybe that's the reason why it's our number one. I mean, that kind of, I don't want to spoil anything, but the big Vivaldi end sequence long shot is, I think, in a lot of people's hearts and minds in terms of cinema this year. Yeah. Even like listening to that piece, I'm like, oh God, like Radio 3 is not relaxing me now, like during the lockdown, if they play anything like that. And then, yeah, we have like really joyful moments. I think Rocks was like such a big film for those, like, yeah, big joyful moments, like the big kind of like home economics, like food fight. Definitely like some kind of quieter moments where it's just kind of friends living their life, like that really kind of give you pause and like make you want to live in that moment. Yeah, it's been such a good year for those kind of those little moments, memeable and otherwise. It's been really good.
That's such a nice range. I think that's just such a nice summary of the breadth of women's stories that we've seen on screen as well, not just in terms of diversity, but like in terms of genre and form and, you know, means of storytelling and authorship. I think this has been just such an exciting year for us. Now, Caitlin, we obviously are here to discuss the 10 best films voted for by women and non-binary people this year, but there were a lot of fantastic examples of what I've just spoken about that sort of made it into our top 20. Could you touch on some of those, what you feel to be really important milestones that just didn't quite make that top 10 for us?
Sure. Actually, before I go into anything that was in the top 20, I wanted to give an honourable mention to a film that just missed out on that, but I think is such a perfect example of a film that really thrived in, you know, COVID times and in this year. And that was the Zoom horror film Host, which was also a hugely female-led film, an incredibly innovative and, you know, ultimately fun, you know, albeit terrifying film that played, you know, played so well on these kinds of, you know, the modern world and the way that Zoom became so prevalent in you know, during this year. And it's just a fantastic piece of work, I think, and really, you know, shows the creativity that can come out of, you know, a period like this. But, you know, beyond that, there was some really brilliant female-led work from Josephine Decker's Shirley and Miranda July's Kajillionaire, two films that I really loved. I think we all felt very fond towards those films. Really, you know, great showcase of dynamic women in interesting, difficult, complex situations. Yeah, just really wonderful films by two kind of, you know, very leading female directors as well. And one other shout out from me, a film that I loved this year was not female directed, but had a powerhouse lead female performance from a actress called Mariana de Girolamo in Pablo Lorraine's Emma is the film I'm talking about. And just such an amazing, bold, stark, impressive, colourful film that really, yeah, I think kind of blew me away and was just such a breath of fresh air. It's totally wild. It's a crazy film, but it's unlike anything you've probably ever seen, and a film that, yeah, I think narrowly missed out on our top 10.
Now we're going to move into our top 10 ranking. You may all have seen this listed on our social media and an article that went out this week on Screen Daily. But this poll and the films that it's made up of are important to us. So we wanted to take a slightly deeper dive into the films that you took the time to vote for with us. And I'm going to start with our number 10. It's Clemency, a weighty, weary account of a woman who works on death row, played by Alfre Woodard. The film is directed by Chinonye Chukwu. Karina, can you tell us a little bit more about this film and why it made our top 10?
This film was a masterclass. I kind of hate saying that, but it really was a really good example of tension and mood. And it had sort of elements of Hitchcockian lighting, I feel. But that's just the production aside. The story was so heavy. I must admit, I wasn't quite as ready for how heavy it was going to be when I watched it. I know Bird's Eye View did a really good job of parading it out across the UK. And then when lockdown happened, loads of different cinemas had this opportunity to watch the film and then whilst supporting your cinema, so they got a cut. So that was a really interesting release strategy there, which I think probably helped more people see it than maybe otherwise. But yeah, essentially you have a very strong, career, ambitious woman who's been working for a very long time on death row, in American death row. And she's going through the motions of talking someone through to their last days. And the performance is just incredible. You have this woman who is supposed to remain professional, cut off her emotions, which, you know, especially for Black women, you've got this expectation of what you're going to be like as this strong Black woman. You're going to be difficult, you're going to be angry, you're going to be loud. But she's so measured and quiet, and I think it's a kind of a response to those awful stereotypes that she's kind of having to be this way when actually you just want her to be normal and express emotion. But ultimately she's just carrying this professionalism of essentially putting somebody down whilst having to shut off her emotions when the parents are coming and just begging for help. But yeah, it really did break me. It was difficult to watch, but in terms of watching it for a performance, in terms of watching it for acute direction, and like I said, in terms of the production, it was a very special film.
So at number 9, not a film I would necessarily say falls under the escapism banner, but more so, I know that, Karina, you mentioned catharsis, people watching films for catharsis, and this definitely touches on some things that we've spoken about already on the podcast. The film is The Assistant. It's the fictional debut from Kitty Green, and the film follows a day in the life of an assistant played by Julia Garner to a powerful film executive. Caitlin, if you could take the lead on this one, just let us know a bit more about the film and why it sits so highly in our ranking.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really interesting one to talk about, you know, after a film like Clemency, because what both those films do so well is kind of work through this very clinical environment and kind of bring that clinical environment into the very production of the film. So the pacing, the rhythm, the kind of the production design and the lighting and all of these elements really build up an atmosphere in both of these films that's hugely effective for both stories. With The Assistant, We've touched on the Weinstein situation, and The Assistant is probably, you know, one of the closest and, you know, in sort of time frame as well as theme, the closest film to kind of, you know, documenting that happening in the film industry. Follows a young woman played by Julia Garner who's starting a new job in effectively what could be, you know, the Weinstein Company. It's never explicitly connected to that, but there's a very clear association there. And she's kind of forced to understand the way that this world works and the horrors of that. And it is this very kind of tightly strung, slow burn drama as she kind of works her way through this office space, comes to understand what her role is, what's expected of her, and what it means to kind of be a woman in that environment. And it was just such a brilliant film and one that's, you know, really stuck with me throughout the year, I think. A very masterful use of camera and casting and direction. Karina used the word acute before for clemency, which I think is very true of this film as well. Just a really brilliant, very concise and sharp, observation of a situation.
I think we're starting to see now, aren't we? This is when we start to see the first wave of Me Too films, which is why there is such a significance in films like The Assistant. And then we also got a film that made it into our top 20, not our top 10, called Bombshell, which was the big awards caliber Me Too film. You know, people were deeming it like the first Me Too film. And I agree with the arguments that was not necessarily the best way to enter into this new form of discussion. I don't know what you guys thought about Bombshell in relation to this film, which, as you say, acute. There's a real sense of dread that's kind of coursing through this film from the off. An astounding performance from Julia Garner. Like, she really is somebody that you can look into the eyes of and think, well, I could either be this person or know her, which I think is great. And then you've got this completely, like, another end of the scale completely, where it's these three women of immense power who they refuse to villainize because, like, heaven forbid they be a villain and a survivor of sexual assault. Our film at number 8 is Baby Teeth. Now, this was a Bechdel favourite, and we were very, very lucky to have Shannon Murphy come on the podcast to speak with us about this film. Baby Teeth is the feature directorial debut from Shannon Murphy. It stars Eliza Scanlon as a terminally ill teenager who falls in love with a local drug dealer. Steph, you spoke to Shannon for us for the podcast. Could you please tell us a little bit more about the film and why it deserves to be so highly appreciated on our ranking list?
Yeah, it was so great to kind of speak to Shannon Murphy about that film and about kind of making this directorial debut of a kind of stage show dealing with such a difficult subject, like kind of teen terminal illness, but also these kind of parental issues of, like, should we let our daughter date a boy who's maybe not suitable for her, that kind of thing. And it's just such a kind of human story. It's so sad, but it's so funny and sharp, and just, like, has this really kind of black humor that you don't really expect going in, or maybe kind of from watching the trailer or reading the synopsis about it. But it's so good, and I just think it really handles all of these conflicting issues really well. All of the characters have their own kind of contradictions going on. You have kind of Essie Davis, who I think is giving such a good performance in this film, worried about her daughter dating a drug dealer, but then she's also, like, taking a lot of prescription drugs and is not really sober for quite a lot of the film. And you have kind of Ben Mendelsohn as Eliza Scanlon's dad, who's kind of dealing with a lot of these issues with his wife, and should he let his daughter, like, do what she wants? How kind of, when do you let a child kind of go off and decide their own future and do their own thing? Like, is 15, 16 kind of too young for that? It's just kind of, it's a real kind of firecracker of a film. And I think especially this year and a little bit of last year, we've seen so many films from Australian directors come out. I mean, you've got Kitty Green, Shannon Murphy, Natalie Erica James, who did Relic, which we talked about on the podcast as well, Jennifer Kent as well, who's, like, kind of a little bit earlier than these other directors. But it's really kind of exciting, and just to see those kind of, like, nuanced stories, especially this one, coming out over there is really, really exciting, I think. Yeah.
Number 7, the only film in our top 10 to be directed by white men, which is wonderful and telling, and I wouldn't have it any other way. The film is Uncut Gems. Uncut Gems stars Adam Sandler as the gauche and shady jeweler. Everyone's laughing at this already. Gauche and shady jeweler Howard. The film is directed by brothers Ben and Josh Safdie. Steph, I'm going to come to you on this one again, but I do encourage everyone to chip in on these. Why are these the guys? Why are these the guys that made, that broke our top 10?
I do feel like if any white men are gonna fit in the top 10, it should be these guys, really. God, what a film. I mean, they are definitely the directors that simultaneously make me want to visit New York and also never go to New York ever. But they do really feel like they're kind of capturing like the city that they obviously know so well in such a unique and original light, and a light of the time that they're living in at the moment. Like, I watched Daddy Long Legs and Heaven Knows What, which are kind of earlier, more kind of like documentary-esque films that they did, where they kind of were working with a lot of non-actors and just people that they met on the street. And this film is such a good follow-on from that, in that they do still have those people. They're kind of going around like New York's jewelers district, and they have a lot of people that they've just kind of picked up off the street in that. But then with the added star power of Adam Sandler, Julia Fox as well, kind of in a bit a breakout role in this film, and she's kind of going on to do a lot more interesting stuff at the moment. This film is like such a mood. It's so stressful to watch. It's so like relentless.
It's incredible. But it's funny actually, because when we got asked how many of the films passed the Bechdel test or not, I did have a little, because I, as far as I can remember, this doesn't pass, but then apparently it does, but scrapes through. But I can't quite work out, I mean, the last time I saw it was at the Prince Charles Cinema, and I just don't have the, my heart rate will go up too much if I watch it again. But it's an interesting one for the female rep. And just by doing a little bit of search online today, I was looking for what people thought of her character. And there's a real 50-50 split on how people either think she's empowering or something to that's actually quite unprogressive. But I don't know, I found a very mesmerising, incredible performance. I just happen to know what her bra size is, but
I think there's two really great female performances in this, you know, Julia Fox, but Idina Menzel, I really love in this film. She's not in it very much, but in the kind of limited screen time she has, she really is just so powerful and adds so many layers to Adam Sandler's character and the kind of world that he's occupying and that, you know, environment. I think the addition of people, as Steph said, that are in the kind of Safdie universe really elevate this film and create this real sense of community and time and place, which I think is what they do so brilliantly.
It's interesting that it was set in 2012, but a lot of critics and journalists are saying that this is the definitive film of this year in terms of political themes, in terms of capitalism, in terms of like the pantomime of politics that we've seen this year, and that it's just embedded in the like utter balls to the wall chaos of this film. I think, you know, we have our critical favourites, we have the films that have moved us this year and the stories that have touched us, and then I think you have the film that truly captures what it's like to be alive in 2020. And I think on so many levels, this like wild, like ghost, grody, like manic film is just so like on the fucking nose, like those terrible glasses that Howard wears. Oh, brilliant. Okay, well, number six on a violent switch of gear is Sept Mort, another blistering directorial debut. The film is made by Rose Glass and stars Morford Clark as a palliative care nurse whose faith begins to take a terrifying form. Now, Caitlin, this was probably one of the most talked about films of this year, partly because it was one of the only films that actually made it out on a theatrical release during lockdown, or in one of the very small windows between lockdowns, and also because it is like explosive. Could you talk a little bit more about why people have, you know, for a first time film, this is not a well-known filmmaker, Morphy Clark is not yet a star, why are people so drawn to this film?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, again, as we've said with a lot of, you know, the other directors we've been talking about, just the ability to have such control and understanding of your story and your characters, and to kind of deploy that with such force and such like great effect is really remarkable. And, you know, for that to be in a debut feature as well is really impressive. This film, Morfydd Clark gives this amazing performance as Maud, kind of working through her religious fanaticism and kind of relationships with the people that she comes across, and her efforts to convert them and to sort of defy, I guess, the more sort of hedonistic lifestyles that she sees of the people around her. And just the kind of the poise and the and I don't even mean poise in a kind of graceful term, but just the complete acting control and again mastery of story and character that Morfydd Clark is able to kind of display here is truly impressive. And I think that's why it's a film that's really resonated with so many people, or just, you know, hit them over the head basically with both narrative and acting. And visually as well, it's you know, such an inventive film and really rich in kind of textures and set design and costume, but, you know, also incredibly stark at times. And there's this really great sort of divide between those two worlds that Rose Glass manages to capture really, really brilliantly. And I mean, you mentioned for Clemency the kind of, you know, opening scene of the year, but I mean, talk about the closing scene of the year for this film, honestly. It's something to behold.
Steph, we've spoken about this quite a lot on the podcast just because of the fortune we've had in the guests that we've had on, but horror and women in horror is having a real moment this year, and this I think is like the apex of that. What makes this film so fucking scary?
I think it's kind of, there's just so much like of the unknown in this film. There's kind of so much going on with this, like, kind of Maud questioning her faith, and then I think kind of coming to maybe a bit of a realization through some quite kind of disturbing and scary William Blake paintings. Kind of like, what does her faith mean? Is she on like the right or the wrong side? Like, what is she even kind of hoping for? Like, what is she putting all of this energy into? And I think that kind of, yeah, like, I guess the idea that maybe everything that you were putting all of your energy into might not actually be that simple and that straightforward and what it seems, is definitely quite scary. I think on like on a kind of gore level, it's a pretty grim film, and I think it's done really well. Like, there's a lot of really good kind of practical effects that really kind of make you shrivel up in your seat a little bit, and yeah, it just feels very kind of visceral, and there's a lot of like body horror that really kind of manifests those slightly more intangible kind of ideas that she's getting at in the film, that really kind of work really well. And I think, I mean, the fact that it's like 80 minutes long, I think it's just a really tight kind of, yeah, really explosive little film that, yeah, just works really well on all of those kind of horror levels.
Definitely. As if Kerwickers hasn't been enough through enough this year, this this is where she really takes a beating. Number five is Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. Four words I never say in the right order. Eliza Hittman directed the film, which follows Sydney Flanagan's Autumn as she travels across state to seek guidance on an unwanted pregnancy. Caitlin, can you tell us more about this film?
Yes, this is a film that I adored this year. I found it incredibly moving, incredibly, you know, angering as well, that, you know, this is a situation that many women across the world face, and that they, you know, have to go to such lengths to get themselves out of or to sort of work through. Yes, as Beth mentioned, it's kind of an abortion drama, effectively. Autumn is traveling to New York to try and get an abortion for an unwanted pregnancy, and she travels with her cousin, who kind of provides this really nice balance to the film, and who adds to this very strong sense of female solidarity that kind of runs throughout the whole narrative. And one of my favorite scenes of the year, actually, from any film, and that still kind of makes me shiver when I think about it, is a moment where the two of them are sort of navigating the city and kind of using an unsuspecting male to get a bit of cash and get a bit of safety, I guess, in the big city. And I won't go into it too much, but there's a moment that they share during this, that kind of scene. And it's just incredibly gentle and subtle and so small, but it speaks absolute volumes for what, you know, women in very different and, you know, a wide range of scenarios can go through and can experience. And it's something that I think Eliza Hittman as a director is, you know, really wonderful at achieving. She can take the smallest moments and sort of imbue them with the hugest sense of meaning and range of ideas. And this is a film that really is another sort of piece of hers that captures that. And really beautiful performances. You know, Sydney Flanagan hasn't acted in anything prior to this. She sings in the film as well. She kind of, you know, offers music to the film. And I think that's, just a really kind of beautiful offering that she gives, and that she, the way she works in this film is really gentle and just lovely. It's just it's a sad film. It is a sad film, but really sort of comforting to know that there are female filmmakers out there and creative, you know, women in film that are telling stories like this and sort of working together to tell these stories.
Yeah, I wholly concur with that. I think it's so important as well to mediate on the hopefulness of this film, because it is uncomfortable on so many other levels. So whereas Sybil is like horror and a visceral sense of discomfort, this is such an insidious sense of what it's like to be a young woman on a day-to-day basis. The number of forms of harassment and, you know, gendered violence, be it big or small, that they encounter is like so exhausting to watch, and yet rings so true to so many people like us or people we know kind of encounter on a day-to-day basis, but yet manages to summon hope, which I think is, you know, that little glimmer is just all that it takes, really. Definitely one, I feel like this is one that's often spoken about but hasn't really had as many eyes on. I would definitely encourage people to kind of step out of their comfort zones a little bit to see this. It's really important, as is our fourth entry in the poll, Lovers Rock, a Fever Dream chapter in Steve McQueen's Small Axe anthology, which centres on a house party in West London in the 1980s. Greena, I have a small inkling you're a fan of this one. And the what seems to be kind of the main thing that the reaction when people say Lovers Rock is to break into song.
Oh, yeah.
We're not going to do
it. It's, I mean... No, I'll spare you. I was questioning it for a minute. So I was like, no, do you know what? Let's not. No. I mean, after watching Lovers Rock, Janet Kay's Silly Games just was uniting the nation. And you could just kind of, I live in a very busy part of Hackney, but where my balcony is, I could hear people singing it. Like shortly after it being on TV, people whistling it. I was just like, "What? Okay." But I mean, they probably were anyway, because, you know, I live in Hackney. But this film is it's the crown of the Lovers Rock series. It's the crown of the Small Axe series that Steve McQueen has gifted us with this year. It's been an absolute delight to have this memory of a London that not a lot of us actually get a chance to revisit. I'm an 80s baby. I do remember the 80s like this. Not so much Ladbroke Grove because I was in East, but this is a house party in Ladbroke Grove in the 80s, and it almost plays out like real time. And I just love the bubbling of the day, like even just arranging the furniture, moving in the speakers, testing out the mic and cooking up all the food. I just remember those feelings of just knowing that there was a big party ahead and you've got to get ready and you've got to get your clothes and stuff, and it just really was evocative of that time. But what's beautiful about this is I think a lot of people needed to remind themselves of what it was like to dance, to sing, to be with people. Even the joy of seeing sweat drip off the walls was just a relishing sight. And, you know, it was realistic as well. Steve does not let us off the hook. He shows us what goes on behind the scenes of a typical London shubs, as we would call it. You know, it's not all fun and games. There's some dodgy stuff going on in certain bedrooms, and there's some... I'm going to rephrase that, because it's not the dodgy stuff in the bedrooms. It's the dodgy stuff in the gardens. Yeah, there is some dodgy stuff going on in the gardens, and there are drug deals going on outside, and there are people making out in bedrooms. And, you know, there a lot. I've been to so many parties where there's suddenly this explosion, where there's a big fight, and then everyone just disperses, and they just carry on. It's great. So, yeah. But yeah, it was, I mean, this is one that was written by Courtier Newland, who is also a musician and a writer. So I think what he brings to this as well is that real musical element, because this is a musical. And I don't think a lot of people are, in my opinion, this is a musical. I don't think a lot of people reference it like that, because there's not much dialogue. There is a romance going on. There is a meet cute, and you see what happens at the end there. But ultimately, this is moved by the music. That's how that's the journey for us.
All the things you've just spoken about there are so, so important. I also think what we can talk about here is we had this really rare, beautiful opportunity to watch this collectively, where it was released as an anthology. We got to see it on a Sunday night. We got to sit down, you know, we're not all sitting together. We're sitting in our respective homes, our quarantined homes mostly, and we got to share this as a communal experience. And I think there is something so impossibly special about that at this time, and feeling connected to so many people. I know certainly for the people that, you know, Steve McQueen is telling these stories about, this holds incredibly true. And as somebody who can only spectate on these things, just being able to share that experience with people in a moment of real time, and to, you know, even the slightly superficial thing of going on WhatsApp, and then just seeing the joy that's coming through from people as they're watching it, you know. And for Steve McQueen as well, who we know does not tend to show joy in his films very readily. He doesn't let people off that easily, and he's not letting people off in this. You know, as you say, he doesn't romanticize the community that he's showing. There is, you know, trauma and trouble, but he also bottles joy in a way that he's never shown before, and I think that is a marvellous gift.
Absolutely. And with all of these, all of the Small Act series, there is a homage to one part of Black British history, and with this one it is the absolute homage to Black music, what Black music has brought to this country, and this is a wonderful love letter to that.
Special, a very, very special entry for us, as is our number three, which is my film of the year, and I could talk about till the goddamn cows come home, and that is Rocks. I'm reluctant to give this to Sarah Gavron, as much as Sarah Gavron is very reluctant to call herself the director of this film, so I'm going to call this a community made film. So Sarah Gavron is the director of this film. It was co-written by Teresa Aikoko and Claire Wilson, but it was also this big, beautiful collaborative effort between the ensemble of largely street cast girls who were workshop, you know, there was a massive casting process. They workshopped the film between them. The stories that we see on the screen in Rocks are a slightly tapered extension of the people who were cast. And what we see is this guts out depiction of East London in a way that to me has never been shown before, and I thought that this was a beautifully crafted, a respectfully crafted, beautifully performed film, which showed the young people at its heart in such a again respectful, raw way. I mean, we've seen kind of collaborative efforts before, people with like Shane Meadows, Andrea Arnold. This just feels like something new and in completely new terrain, and it just excited me so much.
All the characters are so brilliant. You feel like if you were to remove any of those characters, it would just be a completely different film. Each of them brings their best self and their unique individualism to this, and it's just such a special blend of wonderful magnetic characters that is just it. And again, it's I think we've talked about this on a couple of other films, there is all these heavy subjects but all these moments of joy, and I think if you're a director that is able to present both on a lovely balance that shows a good dynamic of them, that's a real good skill.
Yeah, I think as we were kind of saying about Steve McQueen's Small Axe anthology, you know, even being on the kind of sidelines looking into a story like that and not having personal experience of it, but the same situation with Rocks, just being able to sort of enjoy how special this portrayal of authentic community and loving friendship and solidarity between women is just so special. And yeah, it was such a beautiful film. This is like a shitty film critic thing to say, but when I saw it at a festival, and all of the crew and the cast walked out onto the stage after the film, and I had full body shivers just seeing that many women of colour come out and stand there on a stage and celebrate this absolutely beautiful film that they'd made. And it's just unspeakably special to see stuff like that.
All right, number two, we're getting into the heavy stuff now. This was Bong Joon-ho's awards season floor sweeper, Parasite. There's so much to say about this film, but we'll try and keep it light. The film is a mediation on class and wealth and follows the Kim family, whose various cons lead them into murky water. Caitlin, could you tell us just like a light entry? Because this film, again, as much as they say that like Uncut Gems was like the definitive film of how we felt, this was a big film for 2020 in a myriad of ways. If you could dissect that a little bit.
Yeah, where to even start with Parasite? I mean, obviously a huge award season winner, won 4 Oscars, I believe, including Best Picture, and was the first non-English language film to do so. And yeah, I mean, everyone who watches this film, if you saw it in a cinema, if you saw it just in your living room, the kind of collective audience response to certain things that happen in this film and the way that the plot progresses, it was just unforgettable. The kind of the uproarious laughter, the gasps of horror, completely, you know, like a bodily experience watching this film. It's brilliantly sharp, funny, you know, the dark is, you know, got quite a lot of dark humour within it. But it also, you know, carries this really kind of like moving thread throughout that, you know, ultimately it's a family story. It's a story of a family fighting for survival in a world that's trying to sort of beat them down in a myriad of ways. The social thriller aspects of this work so, so well, but equally, you know, it, as I say, it is this kind of moving family story that carries everything through to the end. Such a brilliant film. I don't even know how to keep talking about it, because it's just a film that you have to see. You have to see it.
I think we have to as well. We can't talk about Parasite without talking about the movement that is the Bong Hive. Which is another major takeaway. I don't know who wants to take up on this, but I think someone needs to. I think people just. Again, this was a really special film. I was talking about it on a TV show, and I have this really vivid memory of the taxi driver who was taking me back to the station telling me that he doesn't really watch international films. But he was going to go and take his son that afternoon to go and see Parasite, because he'd seen this guy on the TV who just seemed like the most approachable and non-Hollywood, non-Oscars person in the whole world was there kind of taking these awards, and, you know, couldn't believe his luck that he was in the company of Martin Scorsese and, you know, was so beloved. Like, what is the appeal with Bong Joon-ho?
Well, I think first and foremost, the fact that he was just like, the Oscars, it's a local award ceremony for America, like I mean, it's such a kind of, yeah, like bringing Hollywood down to size a little bit with, like, it's not the be all and end all, like the worldwide kind of decider of best film, but it is really exciting that that film was recognized. And like, I mean, we have like quite a lot of new filmmakers in this list, but then we have kind of people, directors in the middle of their career, and then like Bong Joon-ho, who's been making films for such a long time, and then this has kind of brought him to more people. I mean, yeah, it's not kind of the fact that he is a better filmmaker now because the West knows about him more, but it's like, I think, really exciting that like more audiences are seeing that film and then hopefully going and seeing like Memories of Murder and kind of the other films that he's done that are just like so fantastic.
And not just that, just films with subtitles, yeah. Because certain people seem to forget that they can read and they're just like, oh yeah, I will watch a film with subtitles now. It can't be that hard if they like it. So, you know, kudos for that.
Brilliant. Wow. This brings us right on down to the number one. Now this won by a lot and I was really pleased because I personally have not seen this at the top. It's ranked incredibly highly on a lot of lists. I haven't seen this top. I'm going to go ahead and say I haven't seen this top any lists that I've seen. End of year lists, personal top tens even. So I'm so, so thrilled. And I do truly believe that this is one of the reasons why, in spite of my sourpuss attitude, we do this poll every year because it taps into something that other polls and other voting bodies just aren't able to capture. So the film that garnered the most votes for us was Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So this was Celine Sciamma's period drama, queer period drama, that stars Adèle Haenel as a young woman betrothed to a wealthy man, and Noémie Merlant plays the artist hired to secretly paint her ahead of her wedding day. Now, Steph, you did quite an extensive amount of work on this for a podcast that isn't ours, Rival Podcast. It's not a Rival Podcast. We love the Curse of Podcasts. But please, will you tell us more about this film and why it deserved the very, very, very top spot for our Bexel Test Fest poll?
Well, yeah, I think it is, like, really great that this stuck with so many people. I think especially because maybe a lot of people working in film would have put it on their list last year when it was kind of on the festival circuit. So the fact that it's kind of been released here in the UK at the start of the year and it's still kind of in people's minds as their best film of the year is really, really special, I think. So it's Celine Sciamma's kind of latest film, and I kind of think the film that she's been working up to throughout all of her career, like, when I was working on the Curzon Film Podcast kind of special episode about Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I kind of went back and revisited her work, and you can really see kind of all of the themes that she's dealing with and exploring kind of move throughout all of her work in kind of Water Lilies, Tomboy, Girlhood, and then kind of really come to this realization in this film. Celine Sciamma's work is like so much about looking and kind of looking as a director, making you look as an audience, and I think it's kind of no accident that this film is all about looking, because one of the characters is literally painting a portrait yes. of the other one and has to look at her all the time. And I think that's like a really kind of good way of exploring that, that kind of theme and that...
It's all that tension.
Yeah, all the tension, and yeah, definitely. It's kind of the fact that you are watching this kind of lesbian romance, and you're kind of, you as a viewer are, there's no kind of, is she, isn't she? It's like, you know, like, you are kind of watching two women fall in love and like watching those kind of, those looks between them happen through kind of the work that they're doing. So I think it's like really, really great. And I think also a really interesting kind of examination of like women's art and that work that women do, especially kind of at the time that it's set, like maybe women doing painting or kind of embroidery, kind of sewing, which one of the kind of housemaids is doing, they may be seen as more kind of domestic and kind of something to entertain them a little bit, not as like a viable career path or something that they can kind of become great at. It's kind of to occupy and keep them busy, I guess. But in this kind of environment where it is only women, and then kind of one man, I think, that appears to kind of ruin everything. you do have this kind of exploration of like women making art, not only for themselves, but in this as a kind of important factor, and I think that definitely cements women making films as art, as a kind of, yeah, an important part of the kind of film landscape.
Amazing.
Is this what encouraged your embroidery, Steph? your 2020 new styles? Yeah, you're like, hang on a minute, where's the needle?
Do you want to tell me how you felt the first time that you saw this film? Just tell me a little bit about your kind of knee-jerk reaction to it when you saw it for the first time.
I think I was kind of transfixed. It's such a visual, you know, visually stunning film. The cinematography is completely beautiful. The landscapes that they're shooting are beautiful. The colours, the costumes, everything about it is so decadent. And it was just such a kind of... such a neat film for me. I love when films have these moments sort of as they come to a close where they really tie up the narrative threads, or they plant small seeds, you know, towards the end of the film that then come into this kind of, you know, really powerful ending. And I felt so satisfied by how it finished, even in the midst of kind of feeling heartbroken, you know, throughout the story and you know, to thinking about how their story ends. But just feeling like I'd watched such a brilliant film, and I'd, you know, witnessed, again, I've said it about so many films that we've talked about, but really a masterful, you know, piece of filmmaking, a filmmaker so in control of their craft and their story, and knowing exactly which beats to hit and which notes to play and how to tie this film together in such a satisfying and beautiful way. I love it.
It's such a wanky term, but I feel like this is, and I do apologise because I'm swearing a lot on this podcast, but I think this is the first time we are truly starting to see her as a mainstream, like, auteur. Like, this is her really taking the ownership.
Definitely.
Terms, and the result is something so mesmeric and beautiful. Karina, yeah. How about you?
Oh, I just felt so satisfied after watching it, and emotionally, I just had this release of emotion, which I kind of really needed. I mean, I'd seen it in the cinema. Where did I first see Portrait? I'm trying to remember, because I definitely saw it at the cinema, but I can't remember where. But I think the second time I watched it was when lockdown had kind of just started, or I was just getting my head around the concept, and I had all these weird feelings and emotions, and something about watching Portrait of Lady on Fire really released them. I felt really satisfied afterwards, and I was just like, oh, I really needed that. And just this pure escapism into this absolute beautiful love story, but ultimately so heartbreaking that they just, without the spoilers, but if you know the ends, it's just so, so heartbreaking. And yeah, what you were saying, Caitlin, about the ending and those moments, it's so earned, isn't it? You get to those particular pinch points and you're like, oh, right, okay, that, yeah. And not a lot happens, but it's just all that build-up has amounted to this moment, and it's just so well-earned. It's just, it's devastating.
Yeah.
Really, really stunning.
I love we have to earn our devastation in 2020. So, yeah. I mean, based on that, it's just no surprise this made our top spot. I've never felt so, like, suspended in the female gaze in my whole life. And everyone just has vocalised that wonderfully. Just out of curiosity, what did everyone vote for as their number one film for 2020?
Mine was Lovers Rock.
I can't remember what I put because I keep changing my lists for different... but let me have a look. What did I put? Actually, for this list, I put Garrett Bradley's Time, which I should have mentioned in the top 10 section. Why didn't I mention that?
Because that was the best documentary.
That was number 11. I should have mentioned that one.
That was number 11, but the first
doc, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, that's a good point. On other years' lists, we've had more of a mix-up of forms. But then, it is what it is.
So we've got Time, we've got Lovers Rock. Steph, what was yours?
I think I put Portrait.
I can check for you, Steph. I've got the form open.
Please do. But after the list, like 2 days after the list closed, I watched Possessor by, not by a woman, by...
Brandon Cronenberg.
David Cronenberg's son. And that is fantastic. It's so bloody and violent, though. But that is, like, really, really good. And I kind of wish I put that down in my top
ones. This is it. But... I mean, there's so many films that are coming out, like, as you said in your thing, Beth, that, like, One Night in Miami, that's a later release. Mm-hmm. There's so many films that have just been pushed and pushed and pushed. Like, I've seen, but then that'll go into next year. Like, what's the film?
Nomadland.
Yeah, Nomadland is just a credible film. Like, yeah, that's a film. Fuck me, that poster as well. Oh, I want that poster. What was Another Round is fantastic. Yeah, that film's good. And then what's the other one? Supernova, which, bloody hell. Like,
that film is sad.
That is a sad film. That was, yeah.
Right, well, on that note, thank you so much for tuning in and listening to us. I think this podcast has just been a really nice thing to come out of this year and this situation. I'm so thrilled that I've been able to celebrate these incredible female voices that have made it onto our screens, big and small, this year with my Bechdel Test Fest Partners in Crime. So I say thank you so much to you for listening to us, and thank you to Caitlin.
Thank you, Beth.
And Karina.
Thank you, Beth.
And Steph.
Thank you, Beth.
I don't know. I didn't want you all to just go around and thank me. This is more us kind of.
And thank you, Karina and Steph.
And thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you. I'm really trying to get you to say bye, but I'm going to leave this in because I like to be thanked.
No, thanks. Yes. On a serious note, it's been such a shame that we haven't been able to do what we love doing, and that is putting on films in cinemas and with an audience and enjoying that experience. But to be able to at least have these regular check-ins with you guys and talk about films that we love, it's just been a very good excuse. So yes, thank you, Beth, for making this all happen. And thank you to everyone that's listened, and we hope to actually do some more of this in real life in 2021. Who knows?
Yes, yeah. I can't wait, and we can't wait to be reunited with our beloved cinemas, as I'm sure you can as well.
Who Is She? A Bechdel Test Fest podcast is a Bechdel Test Fest production. It was hosted by myself, Beth Webb, and produced by Steph Watts, with additional help from Karina Antrobus and Caitlin Quinlan. Our music was written, produced, and performed by Zoe Mead. Check out her band Wildest on all major streaming platforms. Like our podcast, please subscribe and say nice things about us on our Apple Podcasts page.